I'm so excited about this story about David and Goliath. In our prayer time this morning, I was saying to Christina, I love this story. I'm so excited. She goes, yeah, why did you get the fun story of David and Goliath? I said, well, it's because I do the teaching schedule. So I guess I was a little self-serving. Okay, well, this story is one of our all-time favorites. It has all the ingredients of the drama and excitement, anticipation, and the satisfaction of the good guy beating the bad guy. There is so much from here, from this story, for us to learn from. I really had so much fun getting into this. I learned so much that I'm so excited to share with you. Okay, in the account of what happened with David and Goliath, where we've been studying, we realize this is a tough time in the history of Israel. The leadership, again, was in serious trouble. What was Israel forgetting about what had happened with their leadership? Well, they are forgetting that God had always been there to deliver them. We started this the very first week. We've talked about it every week. We even referred back to the time of Judges, to where when they were turning their backs on God, then their enemies always began to overtake them. This was a consistent pattern. And we saw this pattern again in Samuel. When they begged Samuel to pray, the enemies were defeated. And in that story in the beginning of Samuel, the picture even looked like while Samuel was praying, the Philistines were being defeated. Whenever they turned back to the Lord and cried out for help, God delivered them. Okay, and in Samuel, 1 Samuel 12, even with the Lord's deliverance, the people begged for a king that they could see and touch. So God gave them what they asked for. Saul was appointed as the nation's first king. They hoped that this king would bring them the stability and the security against all their enemies. They wanted a king so that the king might go out before them and fight their battles. Well, they get Saul. Well, and then Saul had been disobedient to God's commands and so had been rejected by God, although he was still functioning as the king. And it says in 1 Samuel 13:8, however, Saul's foolishness led to the defeat of Israel. There was hard fighting against the Philistines all the days of Saul. And as Christina said last week, that the Lord was sorry he'd given Saul his spirit, and he wanted the next king anointed. So now, a new king has been chosen by God in 1 Samuel 13:14. Secretly, he had been anointed at Bethlehem by the prophet Samuel. And I love this verse, the Spirit of the Lord rushed upon David from that day forward. So now we come to this fun story, the account of David and Goliath in chapter 17. Okay, so the Israelites are always pretty sure that what is their biggest threat? What is their biggest problem? They're always sure it's the enemies. They think their problem is the Philistines. The Philistines are not their biggest problem. Their problem, we see God's mercy over and over again. Their problem was their constant temptation to forget or forsake their God and to follow other gods. You kind of want to think, how many times are they going to have to get this? So now this chapter opens with the ominous words. Now the Philistines gathered their armies for battle. The Philistine threat has been part of all of 1 Samuel, and it's going to be there till the end of the book. And right now we have a particular threat by a particular Philistine. I'd say a very big Philistine. Verse 1 tells us where they are. They are gathered at Soko, which belonged to Judah. So as that says it belongs to Judah, it shows that the Philistines have encroached on the Israel territory. Second, we don't see a lot of active leadership in this first section of 17. The men were gathered. Saul was among those men, but we don't hear of any of his leadership. So we have weak leadership, and this huge monster comes on the scene. Verse 4. One thing, he was huge. So I'm going to... I thought I was going to have somebody like stand over me, but I couldn't even do it here to say how tall he was. If I'm 5'7", he was 9 feet 9 inches. So he's 4 feet taller than I am. He was wearing 126 pounds of armor. Some of you only weigh 126 pounds of armor, and this is how much armor he had on him. He had a bronze helmet, and his upper body was covered with a coat of metal. His legs were also protected by bronze armor. His defenses gave all the appearances of being impenetrable. And he carried a huge weapon, and he also had a shield that was so huge, he needed a servant to carry it out to the field for him. Okay, so now add to this whole scary scene. It's not just what they're looking at, but now this huge, gigantic bully, he starts yelling at him. I thought, this reminds me of a bully in high school. He starts yelling at him. He says, "This day I defy the ranks of Israel. Give me a man and let us fight each other." Okay, what is scary about this is he's coming out because they don't have great leadership. This Philistine was as powerful and threatening with his words as he was in his presence. He was a terrifying enemy. So what do the Israelites do in verse 11? Saul and the Israelites were dismayed and terrified. This is their reaction to Goliath. They were dismayed and terrified. Okay, so things are not looking so good for the Israelites in the valley. So now we look at verse 12 and enters our main character that Christina introduced last week. As she said, this is the one through all these weeks we've been waiting to meet, David. David is the youngest of four boys. David was too young to go into the army with his brothers, but he had to stay home and look after his father's sheep. Can't you imagine how frustrating that was for him? I was the third, and I had older brothers, and I just knew the feeling of always saying, "Oh, you're too young to go," and always wanted to be included in everything. I mean, this is probably what David was. I just want to get out there. As Christina said, this is not necessarily the one, because of his appearance, that we might pick to become king. I love the verse. The Lord does not look at the things man looks at. So David's dad, he wants a report from the front lines. So he sends David with food for his brothers to get the scoop on what's happening. So what is happening? For 40 days, twice a day, morning and evening, the Philistine giant strutted in front of the Israelite army. He was an obnoxious, monstrous bully. So I'm going to say he was also very repetitive. He doesn't do much, but he comes out every morning kind of beating his chest. He's like a kid, "I'm going to beat you up." So David obeys his father to take food to his brothers that are at the battle lines. He left the flock with another shepherd. All of what David is about to experience started as a very normal day obeying his father. He was told to leave. He goes, "Well, I still have to have somebody take care of the sheep." We've learned that very ordinary situations can be the beginning of extraordinary things, because David's going to have quite a day. So here, Israel and the Philistines were drawing up their lines facing each other. David left his things, and he ran to the battle lines. So Goliath comes out again in his bullying, intimidating voice. And what did the Israelites do? They ran the other way. What does David do? Well, as they are running with their tails between their legs, David asks his first question, "Who is this uncircumcised Philistine that should defy the armies of the living God?" This is the first thing he says. So David, right away when he is faced with this guy, he starts talking about God. The living God. He starts talking about God. Of course, his brothers should have been so proud of their little brother's courage. Well, not really. They were kind of offended that this little twerp of a brother thought he could come in and stick his nose in where it didn't belong. But David saw, as apparently no one else did, that this Philistine, this pagan worshiper of dead gods, was mocking not only Israel, but worse, Israel's God, who alone was the living God. David sees what others don't, and he refuses to see what others do. They are running away from him, and David is facing into him. Not only his brothers harass him, but Saul also told him, "You can't fight this giant." Well, in their defense, you can understand why they would say that. Here's a skinny kid too young to leave home. To think that he could fight this yelling, huge, 9-foot monster was a little unbelievable. Then David reminds them of what is true. It is God who will deliver them. They see the giant. David sees God. David sees God more. He sees God more than the giant. David says, "The Lord who delivered me from the paw of the bear will deliver me from the hand of the Philistine." Okay, I love this part. What is David doing, like we talked about a few weeks ago? He's remembering his Ebenezer stone. I loved our whole talk about the Ebenezer stones, that we need our stones to remember where God has helped us, where God has been faithful. So he's remembering where God rescued him. David is remembering his Ebenezer stone. And this was verse 37. That he'd rescued me from the paw of the bear. David is thinking about God. David's battle cry is not, "I'm so scared, you're so huge, I'm going to be killed here." But he says, "You come to me with a sword and a spear. I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel." David sees the armies of God. He sees more of God than he sees of Goliath. And the result of his perspective, I'm going to put this over here, he has great perspective. I'm going to say these are the stones that we need to fight our giants. But David has great perspective because he knows that his God is bigger than Goliath. And the reaction of that perfect perspective, he runs towards the enemy. He picks up 5 smooth stones. Goliath mocks him again and throws his head back in laughter. I hate this guy's arrogance. Anyway, throws his head back in laughter, just enough to shift his helmet and expose a square inch of forehead flesh. David spots the target, seizes the moment. The stone torpedoes through the air and into his skull. Goliath's eyes cross and his legs buckle and he crumples to the ground. What a fun story. This little guy wins. But why? There is so much for us in this story. We have all heard that God helps us face our giants. And now I want to go through and show exactly what David can teach us how we can face our giants. We all have, and we have had our giants. The giants we encounter all have different names. We have fear. We can have discouragement. We can have loneliness. We can have worry, grief, temptation, anger, resentment, doubt, failure, jealousy. Call them whatever you want, but they are still giants, just like Goliath. Which giant right now is giving you grief? So I want you guys just to take a blank piece of paper, and nobody's going to see this. Or you can even write it in your book. This is just for you, unless you want to share this later. And just a word or a sentence, but I want you to write down what consumes your thoughts, creates concern or anxiety in your life right now. What is your giant right now? Okay, did everybody write down something? Okay, now, generally speaking, you don't have to share yours, but I thought just as women, let's just share generally what are some giants that we face? Just verbally. Sometimes what this does, it helps us so much is to think when somebody else verbalizes something, you thought, gosh, I struggle with that too. Financial? Oh, yeah, go ahead, Liz. Yep.
Mm-hmm.
children and their futures. Huge for moms.
Health.
Barb. What?
Forgiveness.
Others?
Financial,
yes.
Relationships.
I'm going to put marriage. Oh, gosh. Yeah, that is a huge giant here. Influenced by the, oh, influenced by giants. Oh, God. Influenced by the culture. our culture is a giant. Any others that you want up there? Okay. So hopefully you guys have something on your own paper that is just for you. So for 40 days, twice a day, morning and evening, the Philistines strutted in front of the Israel army. Yours does the same thing. First thought of the morning, last worry of the night. Our Goliath dominate our days and infiltrates our joy. So now we're going to talk about, from David's example, how to face these. So how did David first handle his giant? He shows up discussing God. The soldiers, if you see in this passage, they never mention God, and his brothers didn't either. No one else discusses God. David discusses no one but God. Everyone else is focused on the giant, his demands, his size, his strut. They have majored in Goliath. David majors in God. He sees the giant. He's not denying the giant, but I love this. He just sees God more. David has perspective. Just knowing which is bigger, my problems or my God. That's how we get perspective, knowing which is bigger, my giants or my God. So let's look at David's remarks about God. In 26, I love all this, he talks about the armies of the living God. In 36, he talks about the armies of the living God. I'm just going to write down the references. 26, 36, 45, he says, the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel. 46, the Lord will deliver you into my hand, and the earth may know that there is a God in Israel. So he just runs out, this scrawny little kid, and starts proclaiming all the greatness of his God. 47, the Lord does not save with sword or spear, for the battle is the Lord, and he will give you into our hands. In this passage, I see 9 references. God thoughts outnumber giant thoughts 9-2. Now, David is not just getting perspective, but what David is doing now, he is pondering the greatness of God. He is pondering who his God is in all of these verses. 9-2, God to problems. How does this ratio compare to yours? Is your list of blessings 4 times as long as your list of complaints? Is your mental file of hope 4 times as thick as your mental file of dread? Are you 4 times as likely to describe the strength of God as you are the demands of your day? I'm not. I wish I were. God gave me a great picture last December about the bad things that I focus on, and I don't focus on the greatness of God. I went to a silent retreat with Lynn Ziegenfuss, who was, some of you have done her retreat, she's so fabulous, and she was talking about the wise men coming and seeking out Jesus. And she said, have you ever been on a long journey that was hard to get there? Well, last September, Terry Gunlock and I climbed Mount Whitney. And I want to say, you're lucky I haven't worked into a talk before this, that I've waited this long. We're quite proud of ourselves. But in a silent retreat, she talked about what was your goal and what were your obstacles to get to the goal. Well, so we climbed, was also with Susan Bramble and Nancy Fitchner. So we had climbed for a day and a half up the front. Have any of you climbed Whitney? Oh, darn, I can't exaggerate now. It's really hard. So for a day and a half, we climbed up the front side, and then towards the, about noon the second day, we are on the back side that has the most incredible view. You are looking down at Guitar Lake, and you're looking at where Yosemite comes in. It was spectacular. And Terry's out on a, she goes, "Let's come look at this view," and she looks at the look on my face. She goes, "What's wrong?" I go, "I'm afraid of heights." And she goes, "Oh." Sweet Terry said, "Well, I'll get you through this." I'm sure she's thinking, we're up 14,000 feet, and now you're telling me you're afraid of heights. And I said, "I really am afraid of heights." I said, "I don't mind being up here. I just didn't ever think there'd be a place that would drop off." And there were places that drop off. And so she was so gracious. She said, "Just follow me. And when I say, look at the granite, that means don't look down here because you will freak out. So, sweet Terry, look at this pretty granite." I go, "Oh, my gosh, I'm going to die if I look." So I'm just going like this, you know. So we walk through this. And there's a place up there, which is so freaky, called the Windows. And if you look at Whitney from a picture, it's these beautiful pinnacles that come up like this. Well, they're great, but where they come back down, they pass the trail. So if it drops off on this side, when you come to the Windows, it also drops off on this side. And that's why they're called the Windows. And I just thought, I can't make it through these windows. And Terry, I can tell you what the back of her hiking boots looked like, because she just kept saying, "Just follow me. Let's just walk." The great thing about this silent retreat, when I started writing, God had so many lessons for me about what stops me towards Him, because the things I look at that I shouldn't look at. And I started writing down, what are my windows that I need to not look at? I would have never made it to the summit had I focused on the windows. And I started writing down, what are my windows? I have windows of guilt. I have windows of worry, all of these. I had windows of comparison with other people in the culture. I had windows of things I didn't do right. I had windows of things I should do. I wrote about 3 pages of really places I should not look if I'm going to keep my eyes on the Lord. God used this hike so beautifully for me to think about, where do my eyes need to be, and how dangerous it is to look at things we really shouldn't look at. I didn't see those views. I'm okay I didn't see those views, because I wouldn't have kept going. Friends get you through. Terry got me through. I mean, she just kept saying, "Come on, it's fine, don't look." She knew what I shouldn't look at. And that we need to do that with each other. We need to say, "No, you don't need to look at this." People came back down from the summit, and this was the most, and there were people that had passed us, and now they're passing us, come back down because we're a little slower than they were. They were so encouraging. And I remember these people coming back, and they go, "You guys, this walk is beautiful. You're going to make it. You're almost there." And I remember going, "Wait, is it way up there?" They go, "Oh, yeah, it's way up there, but it's so worth it." I go, "Wait, there's snow." They go, "Oh, no, you have to walk through snow." But yet, I love that picture. It's a long way. There's a lot of snow. It's hard, but every one of them said, "It is so worth it once you get there." So then we're coming back, and my friend Nancy probably did not quite understand my level of fear. We came back, she was so funny. So coming back, and I walked through a window, she goes, "And the view was gorgeous. You've got to walk back and walk through it again." And I'm going, okay, that's the stupidest thing anybody's ever said to me. And I thought so much, and I know the Lord just did that to give me this example. I think Satan comes to us, he goes, "No, let's revisit your worries. Let's look at these again. Let's look at your concerns. Come back and let's do this again." And I just thought this was such a great picture for me about listing the things, my Goliath, that I need to not look at, because Satan knows it's going to trip me up. Satan knows it's going to keep my eyes off the goal. And the goal is Jesus. And it's not an easy road. It's long. We're going to walk through some hard stuff. But just the picture of these people coming back, the encouragement of the saints is like, it is so worth it. So I thought this was such a, I still think every day, okay, that's a window. I don't need to look at that window. So what are your windows? Kind of the same thing as your giants. What gets your eyes off the Lord? Is it guilt? Is it fears? Is it comparisons? Is it resentments? What do you need to avoid revisiting to keep your eyes on Jesus? Remember, Satan is saying, "Oh no, let's look at these again." So pondering on the greatness of God, just as David did in all of these verses, will give us the correct perspective that David had. You can't get your perspective without focusing on who God is. Then we need to pursue God, to draw closer to God, to help us confront all these fears. So I'm going to say pursue God. This is not just who God is. This is not just the knowledge of who he is, but this is our personal, intimate relationship. Our fear level is ultimately a yardstick on the closeness we have with God. This was very convicting to me. If we spend time in prayer, developing an intimate relationship with our Creator, we should be less likely to shrink in fear at the appearance of every human anxiety. We've seen his power. We've seen his faithfulness. We've seen that his purposes are always best for us. There is a great verse in 1 John 4:18. There is no fear in love, but perfect love casts out fear. 1 John 4:18. About fear. 1 John. He who fears has not been made perfect in love. The opposite of fear is not courage. The opposite of fear is love. 2 Timothy 1:7. God has not given us a spirit of fear, but of power and love and of a sound mind. So think about a time when you had young kids at home, and a lot of you still do, when your kids woke up in the middle of the night scared. When you went into their room, when they'd had a bad nightmare, or they were just afraid of the dark, what did you say? You did not, as a mother, go in and say, okay, just be courageous and buck up. No. We tell our children, and if you did, you shouldn't, okay? don't do that anymore. Hopefully, we tell them, we love you, and everything is all right, and that I'm as near to you when you sleep, while you're in the dark, and that I will always protect you. We want to reassure them of our love. We pour in all of the love we can until that fear is cast out. And hopefully, if it's that simple, young moms are going, yeah, our child sleeps in peace sometimes. But this is exactly what God does when we call on him. He so wants us to leap into his arms when we're afraid, and he wants us to understand that he will always be near enough to protect us from all of our giants, no matter how much they're strutting and yelling. So the more closely we walk with him, the more his love begins to dispel our fears. This is pursuing our relationship. And I want to give you the other verse, 2 Timothy 1:7. He has not given us a spirit of fear. And this really hit me so much, thinking, I am a person that would tell you, oh, I'm so secure in God's love. I trust God did it. And I would also tell you I'm a worrier. And I thought, wait a minute. I can't have those two coexisting. And I thought, something's out of balance here in my life if I think, yes, I'm so secure in his love, but I'm going to tell you I'm still a worrier. And I thought, this hit me. I thought, what I need to do is really focus more on his protection and his love and where he has been so faithful. And my goal is to get away from the worrying and more secure in his love. Now, I'm not going to totally be there till I get to heaven. But I thought, it's not okay for me to say I have both going in my life at the same time. Yeah, a little bit of worry, you know, but I thought, they cannot be equally coexisting in my life. Or something is out of whack. And what's out of whack is my trust in his love. So this was so helpful to me. So when I say I'm a worrier, you can say, ah, you shouldn't be. So we've learned so much from David, but there's still the most important part to talk about. So we've talked about our giants, how God can help me with my fears, how he can help me with my struggles, how he can help me in my dark nights. The problem in all of this is, who's this all about? It's all about me. The main subject is me and my fears. And sometimes that is so much what our life is about. It's all about me and my struggles. And we think it's humble because it's our struggles. It's still all about me. It's all about God. Look what David says in verse 46. I love this. That the earth will know that there is a God in Israel. What David is doing here, there is purpose in his giants. So 46, that they will know, that the earth will know. This should be more what we say than talk about our fears. But that the earth will know that there is a God in Israel. David gives little thought to the giant at all. What he sees is an animal bent on the destruction of God's people and the dishonoring of God's name. What would it look like for me and for you if every trial / giant we saw as a matter of God's glory? David saw Goliath as a chance for God to show off. Did David know that he would live through this battle? No. Chances were he wouldn't, but he was willing to give his life for the reputation of God. Your suffering is God's chance to flex his healing muscles. Your sin is God's opportunity to showcase grace. Your struggling marriage can billboard God's power. See your struggle as God's canvas. Talk in your groups how God has been glorified in your struggles in the past. How can he be glorified now with the struggle you wrote down? How can we shrink the giants and magnify the Lord? So which of these P's, perspective, to see the giants in light of God's greatness, the pondering, just like David, he's just listing all the things he knows about God before he faces his giant, the pondering of who God is, to pursue God in that love relationship. There's a great saying in experiencing God. God pursues you with a love that is real and personal. That is the love we have from God. It is real and personal. And when we are secure in that, we should not be as fearful of this. Or purpose. Is there purpose in your suffering? And the result is, as Isaiah says, peace. Isaiah 26:3. God will keep you in perfect peace for those whose eyes, those who are pondering on him. So as David took 5 stones, and you guys can come up with more. I thought you could even come up with more P's if you wanted to stay with the P's. I thought there's prayer. You know, there's all sorts of things. What are other stones that you would need? But my question is, with the giant that you're facing now, and sometimes we have more than one giant, the next time this giant starts screaming at you, reach for a stone. Which stone do you need to reach for? And so I'd say, talk about this in your groups to say which of these 5 will help you in dealing specifically with these. And Leslie, where is Amy Powell? Amy sent me a great YouTube thing, a song about David. Leslie, do you need this down? You don't really have to watch it, but she needed it to click it. They don't need to watch it. It's just to listen to it. It's a song by Chris Tomlin, Your Heart, about David. Okay, she's got to click something. Do you need me to move it down?
So people can
look at it.
About your tripping from my head, I never did dream beyond the pastures I could tend. It never was about the praise, and not about the street parade. Didn't really need a crowd when Goliath fell down. I never meant to woo a king with simple shepherd songs. Or hide away inside a cave, safe from danger's arms. I never meant to wear a crown or try to bring armies down. It never was about me and who I hoped to be.
Announcements for you. As many of you